I wanted to be the success story so bad and show that everything that we're talking about can work. And I went from a 7 to a scratch. I just wanted that so badly because I thought that that's what I was supposed to do. But with work with my own coach and in life and otherwise, like I realized, I think the failure actually is more helpful to people. Sometimes it's just a bad swing. You know, sometimes you don't have to analyze and have an answer for everything because that can send you into a tizzy too of constantly needing to figure out what happened. Sometimes you just need to acknowledge that the game's hard and move on.
There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
And now, the Member Guest Podcast!
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rippin', rippin'.
All right, Evan from Par Train, been trying to get you on for a while, but from myself, Andy, and the Member Guest Podcast, congratulations on soon to be a dad. It's taken us a little bit longer to get this scheduled because you've got a lot more important things going on, but thanks for finally taking a little bit of time and hopping on.
I wouldn't say that, but yeah, I'm super excited. It's wild to think I just celebrated my birthday yesterday, and it's weird. I was telling this to my wife last night. It's weird to celebrate my birth a month before my kid's birth. You know, like I'm going to be his dad, and we're going to celebrate his birthday. And I was celebrating mine today. It was surreal. But yeah, I can't wait. About a month away.
Yeah, man. Congrats. All my buddies say it's like one of the, it's the peak of life, right? Getting to be a dad and celebrate all those things. And I'm happy and excited for you. So we'll get you now before life starts to take a little bit of a turn here. And yeah. I first wanted to start out, like, I know a lot of my friends follow your podcast, your content. It comes up all the time. Curious if you could just like tell the story about how it started, because for us, we talk about how golf has really taken off over the last, call it, I don't know, 3-ish years, really since COVID. That was a big turning point. And so I'm just interested to hear how the hell you took this thing from, you know, maybe just like creating it to now being a full-time gig for you.
Yeah, crazy story. And I don't think it's a very common one, but my best friend growing up, his name Ryan. He was always like the number one or number two ranked amateur golfer in Missouri, where I'm from. I'm from St. Louis originally. I'm in LA now. But at his age group, he was always kind of, let's say, in the top five of amateur golfers, right? And so he was my childhood best friend. And then he went to play college golf at Missouri State and met a guy on his team named Matt Cermak, who became his college best friend. And so Matt and I, Ryan, our mutual best buddy, is a kind of a connector. Like anyone who knows him, he kind of connects you to his other circles, right? And so Matt and I became really close just by trips we'd go on, and Cermak would come in town, I'd fly in, whatever. And but it really took another level when it was Ryan's wedding, I think 9 years ago. We gave a joint speech as the childhood best friend and the college best friend together at the Ryan's rehearsal dinner night before his wedding. And we kind of brought the house down. Like it was, we did pretty well. And there was just like, it was fun. Like it was, there was a spark between us. We loved having a mic in our hands. And I don't know how a wedding speech turns into a golf podcast. But after that, we were like, we should just do something together. And then it's interesting, you know, I'm a believer that everything happens for a reason and there's little synchronicities all around you if you're able to notice them. And I started to get, I worked at Uber at the time, and I got into the office and the girl I sat next to at the desk was like, I was telling some story about my Uber that morning. And she's like, you know, you should host a podcast. You like have the voice for it, which I don't understand. I don't think I have a radio voice, but for some reason, that's what she told me. And she said, you're a great storyteller. I feel like you should have a podcast. And so I just kept getting like little signs like that, little nudges. And then Matt and I started the podcast over 8 years ago and didn't even start as a mental show. And now we're the number one mental show in golf. So we could talk about that if you'd like, but it's just, it's funny to see how it evolved. And, you know, I'd say the hardest thing about starting something like that is no one listens at first. And I think all of us want to start something, whether it's an Instagram page or whatever, and just get the viral, be the story about, oh, I grew to 100,000 followers in the first month and now I quit my job. And like, that's not how it was for me. Like, I posted 4 times a day, podcast a week for years, you know? And I think that's a key, is if you love to do it and you're willing to do it for free, which we did for many, many years, I think that's, that has to be the key ingredient, because nothing else will keep you going other than the love of it and trying to, and not doing it to try and become something, but to do it to genuinely feed your own soul, but probably more importantly, like help someone else. You know, like we want to help frustrated golfers enjoy the ride again, because I know what it's like to have serious anxiety before a round. I know what it's like to cancel a round before the day before with someone. I know what it's like to go to a bucket list place and have a terrible time. Like I've done all of that. So I get it. And our show is designed to decrease the amount of times that something like that happens.
Yeah, you clearly have a very solid mission and like foundation for why you started it in the first place. And ours was always to have fun with it. And I think you're right. Like we started doing it for free. We're still doing it for free, but we love it. And like, for me, it's a kind of a creative outlet as well. And back to like your point of why you started, or like when you actually started the podcast, one, why was it a golf podcast? And two, why was it more focused on like the mental side of golf things? Like how did you settle on that? Not, I don't know what your other passions and hobbies are, but like, how did you guys land on that?
Yeah, well, it's the thing that Cermak and I share. We're both golf nuts. You know, our mutual buddy Ryan is one of those guys that's never known what is the best club for him to play. He has no idea why or what he does in his swing. The guy's just a like natural born ball striker. And Cermak and I are not, even though Cermak's a scratch player and played in college, his short game is really like what's elite for him. And for me, I'm an 8 handicap that, you know, has struggled in all different types on the course, and ball striking hasn't necessarily come easy. So I think Matt and I both kind of geek out. We want to know why things happen. We want to know why certain things work and why certain things don't. And we actually didn't start as a mental show. We started as a kind of PGA Tour comedy. So we would talk about the tour and try and bring like a different kind of unique take to entertainment around the pro golf space. And then it was probably like a year or two in, maybe two, maybe even 3 years in. I'd have to look back. I don't even remember. But I remember thinking, you know, it doesn't matter how good of an interviewer we are, we're never going to get the access that a PGA Tour podcast, you know, or a Barstool would get, as an example, right? Like, it doesn't matter how good their show is, but a PGA Tour podcast, even if the interview is terrible, are you going to get guys like Tony Finau and Scottie Scheffler and whatever? And so for me, I was like, why don't we lean into something that is like what makes me, you know? And I, for years, was kind of embarrassed by this. I've read like hundreds of self-help books. Like, I used to like look over my shoulder. I'd go down the aisle in a Barnes and Noble and like pick up another self-help book. I've read books with angels and hearts on it and like hid it in my backpack. And it's just like, as a guy, it's like not something you really talk about, you know, but it's something I've been really passionate about since I was 16. And I just saw what changed in my life since I was able to learn about how my mind worked and how the lens at which I looked at my life totally changed my reality. So we just started talking about, we did one episode about the mental game. We have a mini series called Chipping Away where we take one topic and dive really deep, totally unscripted. And we did one on the mental game. It performed really well. And it was like the most fun I'd ever had on the podcast. And so we just kind of like leaned into that, you know, like I wasn't even trying to find a niche at the time. I was just like, this just feels natural. It feels like me, where the other thing felt like I was trying to become something big. You know, I was trying to get the views. I was trying to grow. When this was just like, I just want to talk about my struggles last weekend. And I want to talk and figure out how to help someone else not go through it, you know? And so that's kind of what it became. And now we interview anyone from someone like you and me to a PGA Tour pro or Tiger Woods coach. And sometimes the guy like you and me performs better than the PGA Tour pro, you know? Yeah, so it's become it's kind of a relatable works, community.
Oh, for sure. Well, and a growing community just over the last few years, like we kind of talked about. Like, I mean, I was into golf, and then I think it was about 2019, maybe right before COVID, where I really caught that bug, and I decided, like, hey, I'm going to stop playing pickleball and recreational basketball and stuff, and like, I'm going all in on golf. And that's how I started stumbling upon, you know, like your podcast and other kind of just golf content in general. And, you know, I've learned over the past 2 years of doing this, there's so many people that are so like golf nerdy, like how we are, how I can tell that you are. And so now I want to ask, over however many years you've been doing this now, what are some of the top things that you've learned, whether it's about yourself and the mental game, or it's like the golf equipment, or just something in general that like really changed your perspective on the game? And for me, I'll give you my example. What I always tell people on the realm of mental golf was like the actual strategy part of the game, and how you can legitimately be like 4 points worse on your handicap. But if you have really good course management, you can beat a scratch golfer or somebody that's like a one or a two solely based off of the smart decisions that you make and, you know, being able to navigate around a golf course. Something I had never even thought about until I like dove down this rabbit hole that we're currently into. So I'm curious what you've kind of learned over the years.
Yeah, you know, I think, and I do some mental coaching too. So I've been certified in mental golf type, which is this coaching system where you take like it's a free assessment. It takes like 5 minutes and you basically get like a Myers-Briggs personality type.
Yeah, but, like the Wicked Smart. Do you know Wicked Smart?
Yeah.
Yeah, the stuff that he does, right? We just had him on. That's funny you say. We had him on like maybe a month ago.
Yeah, I think he's a certified mental golf type coach as well.
Yeah,
I think. But I'd say what's been really eye-opening is like golf is a really interesting mirror for a lot of people of this fact that you bring someone different to the golf course than you bring anywhere else in your life. So like one example, I'll give you me for an example. If you look at my mental golf type, I'm an extroverted, intuitive feeler perceiver. So there's no part of my mental golf type that is analytical or process driven. I'm all kind of feel, perception, creative, right? So why is it that when I go to the golf course, I'm thinking about technicalities in my swing the entire time? Right. The only place in the entire world that I get technical is the golf course, which is a reflection that I'm stressed. Like that's what they call stress mode. So it's interesting what you can unlock when you bring your authentic self exactly how you are and play golf that way. Right. So even though I have past failures and misses and lost balls and embarrassments and all that stuff, and my brain so badly doesn't want me to go through that again. Therefore, it gets technical and tries to help me problem solve and fix, which then inherently goes into my swing positions. If I then refocus to like obsession with my target instead of obsession with my swing positions, and I try and create shots and I try and get creative and I try and see it go over the tree. Like, why do we always hit great shots out of the trees? You know, it's because you have a very clear target of where you can go. And we're usually focused on like the opportunity to recover versus like messing up like you would in the middle of the fairway after a great drive. So I think that's really interesting, is like, how can I lean into who I am? You know, like, how can I lean into creating shots? How can I stay big picture? How can I not get in the weeds? How can I not worry about what other people think? I think that's a big one.
Have you figured out how, and I don't want to make this like a free, you know, mental golf session, but I'm still going to ask the question.
Please.
Have you figured out how to stay in that, you know, like the rounds that you do actually lean into who you are, lean into the creativity? I've learned like in golf, it's so easy. I mean, it can literally happen whether it's one shot or a full hole where it's almost like you black out. And then at the end of the hole or after the shot, you just go, what was I thinking? Or what was I even doing there? I wasn't even in my normal process that I'm in every other shot, which is what makes golf beautiful, but also difficult. Have you figured out how to like stay in that mode for as long as you can? Is it like a pre-round thing? Is it like something that you check in on? Like, how do you do this? Because this is what I struggle with the most by far. It's hard for me to stay in my entire process the entire time.
Well, so one of the biggest traps is thinking that we have to stay in it, actually. I would say the practice is knowing you're not going to stay in it and instead play in a world of curiosity instead of judgment. John Rahm, sports psychologist, told me, see it as a puzzle, not a mirror. So one thing I learned from Colin Morikawa's coach that they do since he was 8 years old, Rick Sessinghouse and him, they would go and practice, and this is going to answer your question in the end. They would practice and he would drop a ball and have Colin hit it, right? This is even like since he was like 8 years old. And he'd hit the first one and he'd say, Rick would ask him, would you change anything about what you did? Right? This is his chance. Maybe whether it was good or bad, let's say it was an okay shot, not great. Well, maybe the rough was thicker than I expected, right? Maybe I needed to take more club there. Maybe I shouldn't have gone for the green. Maybe I needed to take a little bit of an angle left because it could get really beaten down by the rough. The rough's really a lot thicker. Okay, drops another ball. Go ahead, right? He hits another shot. Then Rick would, number three, after number two, he would then say, would he change anything? And then number three, Rick would tell him to hit a shot in a certain way. Rick would have a chance to kind of give him new instructions. And the point of that exercise is the post-shot routine is arguably as important as the pre-shot routine, because if you mess up or you make the mistake you most want to prevent, if you just go from embarrassment, frustration to speeding up and trying not to do it again in the next shot, then you don't really know what happened. And that's why it kind of feels like you black out, right? But if you see it kind of like a puzzle and you're like, okay, I'm off the first tee and I blocked at OB. It's the one shot I hate the most and I was trying not to do it. Okay, I blocked at OB. I'm stepping back. I'm about to hit my second ball off the tee. What happened there? Oh, was I focused on my target? Did I stay in my posture? Did I focus on good rhythm? Or did I try and not do something? Did I try and prevent a miss? Oh, I tried to prevent a miss. Yep, I do that sometimes. All right, on this one, I'm instead going to focus on swinging 85% and knowing that early in the round, I get tight and I get quick. So I'm going to focus on taking an even bigger turn at 80% and I'm going to aim at the left side of the fairway or the left rough, because I have a tendency to fade it. And I'm going to do that instead, right? Like, that's a totally different way to play, because you just learned from a loss of focus versus like yelling at yourself and telling yourself that you suck, which you might do automatically, right? It's just a reaction. But like, if you carry that to the next three holes, trying not to suck, you're not actually addressing what happened in the moment of suck. You know what I mean?
Oh, 1,000%. You're explaining like at least two shots around that happened for me, like right there. I play with some of the Champions Tour. His name is Mario Tiziani. He's an unbelievable golfer. He's a member out at our club. And I don't know why I was thinking this the other day. We're starting to have some of this weird mojo going on. But one of the things that he always says whenever we play, he says it at least two or three times, not only to me, but to other people that we play with. We'll hit a shot, and it's usually like it's on like a good one or maybe an okay one, and he'll go, "Do you want it back? You want to redo it?" And I feel like he's like unlocking that mental, like what you just said, which is like, you're going to hit a shot, and after it's done, like, I don't know, like, do you want to redo it? I mean, you hit it to 20 feet. It's not that bad,
yeah.
Right? Like, or hey, like, you hit a really good putt. I know it didn't go in, but it's a tap in. Like, do you want to redo it? And the answer is like almost always no. And I think like the point he's trying to make, or maybe something that he does for himself, which is like, you know, you might not hit the perfect shot, or like you didn't hit it to 5 feet, but like if I let you go back and do it over, are you going to? Like, the answer is almost always no, even when it's just like an okay shot.
Yeah. And if you do want to redo it, what do you want to do differently?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not just change the result, but like what happened in the approach that led to a poor result? And sometimes it's just a bad swing. You know, sometimes you don't have to analyze and have an answer for everything, because that can send you into a tizzy too of constantly needing to figure out what happened. Sometimes you just need to acknowledge that the game's hard, you know, and move on.
Yeah, you just swing a bad one. So you've been along with this mental golf stuff, I mean, a lot of the content that I see you do, you're also talking with, like you said, coaches or maybe instructors. I'm curious your own thoughts on your game and how it's evolved over the years as you've been doing this, because I find that I go through these ruts where like it can almost be information overload and I'm trying too many different things from too many different ways of teaching or whatever it might be, you know, in my game, like it always does, goes up and down. But I'm kind of curious, like, does all this stuff help? I mean, is it all, can it be too much? I mean, what are the secrets you've unlocked, and what are some of the things that are just like, man, I don't even know why I just tried that or why I just did that in the first place.
Yeah, learn from my mistakes. The interesting experience I've had is as the show's gotten more popular, my game got much worse.
Really?
Which shows I'm kind of coming on my way back now because I'm kind of getting back to basics. You know, I'm trying not to change stuff. I'm trying to make tweaks, but not, you know, one day try something entirely new, the next day try something entirely different because it didn't work, which I've done thousands of times. But it shines a spotlight on a very interesting thing, which is it shows the power of our identity, how we view ourselves, and then how we identify with our performance. So I can't tell you how many times I've gone on a golf trip. I played in a Ryder Cup thing, which I have every year, or I get matched up with a random 70-year-old guy and they're like a 20 handicap and I'm a 7 and I block it OB 4 times. I can't hit the fairway. Doesn't matter how hard I try. I literally can't hit the fairway. And this guy is hitting greens with woods and I can't hit the green with a 9-iron. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've experienced that. And then when you factor in, and this is at my lowest, right? Like, when you factor in the things I was inherently telling myself, I have all the access. I do this for a living, which isn't true. Actually, I don't play golf for a living. I talk about it for a living.
Big difference.
People don't pay me.
Very big difference.
People don't listen because I'm good at golf. People listen because I can help them become better by the way they think about golf. I had that reversed. I think for many years, I wanted to be the success story so bad and show that everything that we're talking about can work. And I went from a 7 to a scratch. I just wanted that so badly because I thought that that's what I was supposed to do. But with work with my own coach and in life and otherwise, like, I realize I think the failure actually is more helpful to people. Like, honestly, I think me telling you this can help your listeners better than what I did to get to a scratch. Because there's a lot of that stuff out there. But I can't tell you how much anxiety I felt over the golf ball in my life. Like, a lot. So much so that I, like, had to breathe in the car for 20 minutes before I walked into my last day at a member guest with my buddy, because the day before I couldn't hit the ball. And it was so embarrassing. And that was the first year, ironically, that people started to recognize me for the show. And so I put all this pressure on myself. I was the guy with the golf podcast, right? And therefore, that was getting totally in my way because I was identifying with the golf. And my identity, I just talked to my coach about this a month ago. My identity is not result to result. My identity is why I'm there. My identity is what I'm trying to learn and shape my relationship with the ups and downs, right? So yeah, I think I've had Damon Hack from the Golf Channel on. He said the same thing. Like, if you're interviewing a lot of great people and you're taking bits and pieces from every single person, it can create a dark hole real quick of just too much information. And I think that's why finding a singular coach, this doesn't mean you can't read things, listen to things, and try things. But I think your foundation needs to be on a very simple path and very small tweaks. So this year I got a coach that we're on a plan and we're working together, and I don't change stuff as much. So that's helped. And I think it's helped calm a lot of the noise internally.
Have you, I love all of that, and I completely agree, because I've done I had one of my buddies that plays professionally ask me one time, he was like, how many people do you like see for your swing? Because, I mean, I've seen a bunch of different coaches, and I would say that I have one main one, but still, I'm always trying something, always looking for what I think that next, like, piece of the puzzle is going to be, because everybody knows that feeling when maybe you go to a lesson or you actually do read something that works, and you have those 2 to 3 rounds that follow and you just feel like you can't miss a shot. I feel like you're constantly looking for that. But in reality, what got you there in the first place was the groundwork, or like the framing that you put in place that helped, you know, maybe unlock that one little feel or whatever it might be. So I'd 1,000% agree with you there. And my follow-up question to that is, are you an equipment junkie yet? Have you gone down the route of, you know, tweaking with all your equipment and all the different drivers and, you know, setups and wedges and putters and fittings? Have you gotten down that rabbit hole like I have?
Yeah, I actually started my career working with TaylorMade. So I know, I used to be in that world. And actually, I just got fit, say, 2 months ago by TaylorMade, and got a whole new set the week before a 3-day trip at Sand Valley. And then a 3-day Ryder Cup trip the next week in Palm Springs at 100 degrees. I wouldn't recommend getting a brand new set before 2 big golf trips. Looking down at new clubs, regardless of if they're fit for you, is just a weird thing. And it takes a little bit to get comfortable and have confidence. I'm starting to come out the other end. But yeah, I mean, equipment is... I had a lot of stuff in my set where I had like a high spinny head and a low spin shaft. And the way the fitter, and if anyone wants to watch this, it's on our YouTube, is a full fitting with TaylorMade. But what was fascinating to me is, like, he's like, well, they're constantly fighting against each other, right? So your low spin shaft is trying to keep your spin down and the flight down. And your high spinny head is trying to get it up in the air, and you never know who's going to win, right? So it's why I would hit like really low drives and then like high rights at the same time. So he put me in like a low spin head and a low spin shaft because I hit it really high. And it is amazing when you get something that's actually fit for you and you get a coach that actually like helps you with your foundational stuff, like grip, posture, setup. I don't think people realize how important setup is. I've interviewed so many pros and I've interviewed so many amateurs. Pros work on basic fundamentals and amateurs change everything. Pros underreact, amateurs overreact. You know, it's, there's so many like crazy differences. And like what I've learned from, so that's some things I've learned from equipment. Equipment's very important. It's not everything, but it's very important. And then what I've learned from my coach this year is if your setup's putting you in a bad place, if like, for example, I used to be like a lot of my weight on my, I'm a righty, on my right foot and my hands were kind of back by my right groin. So I had to kind of flip it inside because there was no other place for it to go. Right. So then if you get more of my weight on my left side, I move my hands closer to my left groin and I turn into my right hip that's now open, like it unlocks things, you know, where before all of those doors were locked based on where my weight and my setup and my posture was. So I'd say that those are the things. Everybody wants to go to a golf lesson and get a quick fix. You get your setup, your posture and your grip right, and you get some clubs that are actually made for you, and you listen to the par train for your mental game, you're probably going to get some pretty quick gains, you know?
Oh yeah. I see every good player that I see on the range always has an alignment stick down. They're always checking to make sure, you know, they're square to the target. Their divots are, you know, square. It's not like super toe heavy or super heel heavy. And a lot of my other guys that I see on the putting green, they're always putting with an alignment stick, making sure that it, you know, they've got their arc the right way and like the setup's the exact same every time. And I guess I had never thought about it specifically the way that you just coined it there, which is you almost always hear pros talk about, you know, their pre-round routines. It's always alignment check, ball position, you know, all the stuff that you can control, right? Like you can control a lot within the golf swing. You can control the ball, you can control the position, you can control your feet, like you said, your weight, your grip. A lot of the times what you can't control is the outcome, right? Like you can swing the swing, you control the controllables. And I don't want to backtrack too much, but I got to ask how your trip to Sand Valley was. Did you get to play the Lido?
I did.
Did you get to play Sedge?
Yeah.
You get to play all the, what's the Sandbox, the Mammoth? Did you play all of them? You play all four
played
of them?
Played all of them. Yeah, we did a full podcast on everything you need to know about going to Sand Valley.
You can see, look over, right? I got Sand, I got Lido, oh, and yeah. Mammoth. I just did my, we live like, I don't know, it was like a 3-hour drive for us from here out of Minneapolis.
I usually fly through Minneapolis.
LA. Next time you go, you got to come out to our course.
Yeah. I love Sand Valley. I actually do consulting with them and all Dream Golf properties. So I love that place. I've been many times. I think they're going to give Bandit a run for their money here pretty soon. With the amount of courses that could be built there and the vibe, the people there are just so special. So I loved Sedge so much. This is my first time playing.
So did
it.
I.
And I thought it was just, you know, I think the true genius of Bandon is the variety and how every course is so different. And, I think Sedge really gives that to obviously the Lido now as well, but Sedge is so different. It's so peaceful and it's in the trees. And I love the forest. I got married in the Redwoods forest. And obviously Sand Valley is not the Redwoods, but still there's something about me being walking amongst the trees that just gets me going a little bit. So I loved every step at Sedge.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I've been obviously to Sand Valley. I haven't been to Bandon. Next year I'm going for my bachelor party.
Oh,
and we're
awesome.
Hitting every course at least once. So I'm super excited to, everybody says like those are the two main resorts. Everybody puts Bandon obviously up there just because of all the top 100s that it has.
Right.
But I still haven't been, so I'd be... What's your favorite Bannon course?
Well, first, make sure you listen to our Bannon podcast before you go, because it lists a lot of first-timer pro tips, first-timer mistakes, etc. So my number one has changed three times. And that's the beauty of Bannon. My first time, Trails was my favorite. My second time, Sheep Ranch was my favorite. And my third time, Old Mac was my favorite. And Old Mac used to be my... Okay. Fifth out of five of the big courses. But for a guy that can spray it off the tee, Old Mac's the biggest fairways and the biggest greens. So, and it's just, so, I mean, you can't go wrong. You're going to have a different answer. Some people have my top picks as their last. But it's just such a magical place. There's no place in the world other than Scotland that you could get top 100, five top 20 courses in the same, you know, same vicinity. So
yeah, it is pretty wild. I saw you were at St. Andrews as well. I mean, what? Let's start talking golf courses, because obviously you've done a bunch now that you're, you know, doing the pod and like obviously going to all these different courses. So I saw St. Andrews. We've talked Bandon. We've talked Sand Valley. Well, what are some of the top five that you've been to? I mean, is it mostly like resort style and public, or have you gone to a bunch of private courses too that we're all going to be envious of, or what are some of your favorite?
I've had a good mix. St. Andrews was really special. I've been there three times. Once I didn't play, I went for the Open in 2010. My buddies and two of my buddies and I were doing the post-college backpacking through Europe, and we realized the Open was at St. Andrews, so we flew north and were there for Saturday, Sunday when Louis Oosthuizen won and nobody knew who he was in 2010. And Rory kind of had a collapse after shooting an 80-something after he was in the lead. But that place is pure magic. This last year was so special. I'll spare you the long story, but long story short, my wife was going through some health stuff. We weren't allowed to start trying to have kids. And so we're like, well, she works remotely. I work remotely. I work in golf. Can ride off the whole trip. Let's do something we never thought we would do. Let's embrace our flexibility and the fact that we don't have kids and embrace our current reality. And we lived in Scotland, St. Andrews for a month and worked from there. And so, you know, the beauty between that is I would work, you know, starting at like 3 or 4 on stuff, whether it's consulting or the par train. And I had all day to do whatever I wanted. So I played a lot of golf there. And ironically and amazingly, my wife kind of healed post that trip. So it was the best trip we could. Like, technically, St. Andrews is why I have a kid coming in a month, basically. So St. Andrews is to thank. But, nothing beats the Old Course at St. Andrews, in my opinion. It's an easy answer, but it's also the right one, in my opinion, because there is nothing like that town. That town is magic. Everyone feels it when you go. I don't know if it's the history or the fact that it's a public park on Sundays and anyone can walk it. There's spectators every time you play. But the town getting closer as you play each hole on the back nine, there's nothing like it. And the people are amazing, and everyone there is having the best day of their life. One of the best days of their life. So it's a truly magical place. In Scotland, I would say the two most underrated courses that everyone should go play is Ely, which I asked everybody that follows us where I should go. And that answer kept popping up, and I had heard of it, but I didn't know anything about it. That course is about 30 or 40 minutes away from St. Andrews. It's unassuming. It's a little hut, and that course is magic. Ely is amazing. And then the other one that kept popping up that everyone needs to go to is Dunbar Golf Club, I think is what it's called. But
yeah, I've heard of Dunbar. I've heard it's good.
Dunbar is unbelievable. Dunbar is like an unbelievable day would be... Like we stayed for a few days in Edinburgh before we flew back, and It's about an hour and a half, maybe a little less, from Edinburgh to North Berwick. And so I played North Berwick one day and Dunbar the next. If you want to do 36 in a day in Scotland, like, dude, North Berwick and Dunbar in the same day, other than St. Andrews, I can't imagine a cooler day than that. Dunbar has this wall that goes along the whole course. There's like lookouts, there's bells that you ring, there's ocean. The holes are awesome. The town is awesome. Like, those two are unbelievable. So you have to play St. Andrews, North Berwick, Dunbar, and Ely if you're in Scotland.
I'm going to have to add it to my list whenever I go. We did Ireland a few months ago. I saw them in Scotland. But we did a bunch of Northern Ireland, which is really cool experience, like traditional Lynx-style golf with like dunes that are 100 feet high.
Yeah.
And so next on my trip overseas is going to be Scotland. And I haven't heard of Ely. I mean, maybe my co-host has. I've definitely heard of Dunbar. And then, I mean, my co-host says the same thing as you. He says St. Andrews is the most special place in the world. He literally booked a ticket solo, just wanted to go by himself, told his...
I've been by myself at the time, as well.
Yeah, fiance, just like, this is what I want to do. I want to go by myself, played as a solo. And he came back and it was just like the best thing ever. Yeah. So two for two so far.
And then I'd say another international spot that everyone needs to know about is Tairai Lynx in the North Island of New Zealand. We honeymooned in New Zealand, and Tairai is a public resort built by the same people that built Tairaiti, which is like a top five course in the world, super private. You might've seen some stuff on YouTube about it. I played Tairaiti as well, which is super cool. Tairai Lynx is basically like abandoned in New Zealand with a Cor Crenshaw and a Tom Doak course. Awesome amenities. Like, it's higher end. It's super nice, but it's super approachable and family friendly. They have the biggest practice green in the world. They've got an amazing restaurant right off of it called Rick's Restaurant, who's named after the owner, Rick Kane. And I did two YouTube videos on both of those experiences. So if you're thinking about a trip, New Zealand is really getting up there as like something that should be considered, because there's no jet lag. You fly from LA direct to Auckland, 12 hours. And you're a day ahead, but 3 hours behind. So it's basically like you're in Hawaii. There's no real jet lag. And you can just go right into your golf trip. No language barrier. It's awesome.
Wow. New Zealand would have never been on my radar. I hear people talk about Australia a lot because of all the good golf there. Have you been to Australia?
I've not been to Australia.
Yeah, I haven't been there yet either. But obviously, there's a ton of pro golfers that come from there. And everybody says there's some just amazing golf town that way, too. So, well, this has been awesome, man. I'm coming up against time. I can't thank you enough. We're going to have to do this again. I want to say thank you for taking some time to talk to a small podcast. And quite frankly, I didn't know where this was going to go. I had no idea you were so big into the mental side of the game, which is awesome. You've clearly done something right, and it's a good thing you listened to that coworker of yours and went into the podcast business. You guys are an awesome follow, something that I look up to, and I'm told to be able to do all the cool stuff you're doing someday. So truly appreciate it, and we'll have to stay in touch. And if you're ever in Minneapolis, come out to our course, Windsong Farm. It's out here by Hazeltine. I don't know if you're going to come for the Ryder Cup in 29, but I live like 7 minutes away from there. So
sweet.
Be awesome to connect, if not before then.
Yeah. Awesome. I appreciate you having me on. This was fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Evan. We'll talk to you soon, man.
Sounds good.